Live from around the world, it's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one frontline travel news journalist. Around the world, the trip begins with a kiss. Roam if you want to, roam around the world. Get on the phone now and call 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, the travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
I hope you're having a wonderful time wherever you happen to be. Let me tell you where we are. 22 degrees, 15 minutes north, 114 degrees, 10 minutes east. We're coming to you from high atop the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Hong Kong. When I say high atop, we're talking 116 stories high. If you define a skyscraper, and the traditional description of a skyscraper, believe it or not, it might surprise you, is a building that's more than 14 stories tall, then Hong Kong has the most skyscrapers in the world, at about 8,000 of them, almost double of that of its nearest rival, which is New York. There's still two or three more floors above us, and we actually timed it from the ninth floor up to the 103rd floor. It's at 1 minute and 10 seconds, and your ears do pop. And it's worth the ride. And in fact, two floors above us, there's a swimming pool, which of course makes that the tallest and highest swimming pool, I think, in the world at a hotel. And something tells me I think they planned that so the weight of the pool would help the sway of the building. Let's hope they did, in any case. And as I do every week at this time on the show, I encourage you to go to our website with the most imaginative name on the planet, petergreenberg.com, to get our comprehensive list of all the aid and relief organizations doing all that hard and essential work in some pretty devastated areas of Haiti, of Japan, Western China, Chile, and our friends down in Christchurch in New Zealand, all of them victims of either tsunamis or earthquakes in the last almost 2 years. And the rebuilding efforts there may even take one or two generations. The cool thing about that list, you'll find yourself pleasantly surprised by it, is how many different things you can relate to. And if you structure a volunteer vacation around that kind of a trip to really help people out, you become the party. Lots of stuff to talk about in the news because, let's face it, you know, we've gotten through another year without losing too many airlines, but the American Airlines bankruptcy is still much with us. They're still shaking things out. Many people are concerned about their frequent flyer miles. They're concerned about flights operating. The bottom line is, think about this. Every major U.S. airline now, and we're talking about major airlines, with the exception of Southwest, has filed for bankruptcy. Some more than once. Some, we have to call it like Chapter 33, not Chapter 11. But now American is the latest one. Southwest hasn't, but American has. They're still operating. They're still paying their bills. Their frequent flyer miles are not going to go anywhere, meaning they're still going to be around. Whether you can use them or not is another issue because, let's face it, when you have fewer planes, that means fewer flights, which means fewer seats, which means that the airline has no incentive whatsoever to give away free tickets if it means displacing revenue passengers. What does that mean? Go to an art supply store, get a picture frame, and hang your miles on the wall because redeeming them is going to be tougher than ever. So your New Year's resolution, which you're not going to wait till New Year's to basically invoke, do it now, is get out your calendar, go out as much as you can, even as much as 330 days out, and then figure out where you want to go, and then forget that. Then figure out where you're going to go. Because where you want to go, everybody else wants to go. They all want to go to Hawaii. They all want to go to Paris. They all want to go to London. Why don't you go to Des Moines? Why don't you go to Kansas City? Why don't you go to like Armpit, Illinois? I don't care where you want to go in that respect. This is your year to be a contrarian traveler if you want to use your miles. Pick a place that no one wants to go to. And boy, you're going to have a holiday there. You are. I mean, just think about that. Who wants to go to Des Moines on a Wednesday at midnight? And I'm sorry, if you're listening to the show in Des Moines, you know exactly what I'm talking about, okay? Because everybody else wants to go to Honolulu. The second thing you want to do is, let's say you do want to go to Honolulu, you don't want to listen to me, then get the map out and burn it. Because what you're going to do instead is you're going to figure out a different way to get there in a completely contrarian way. So instead of going Los Angeles-Honolulu, try to throw your miles in so that you go Los Angeles-Las Vegas-Honolulu. You go in the exact wrong direction. Or Los Angeles, Chicago, Honolulu. Or let's say you want to go from Los Angeles to Singapore. Well, people forget that there are other airlines that fly it the other way around, like New York to Singapore via Frankfurt on the same airline, otherwise known as Singapore Airlines, as opposed to the nonstop flight from LA to Singapore, which everybody else wants to do. So your goal here is to really beat them at their own game playing by their rules, because right now playing by your rules is not going to work. Your miles are going to become exponentially devalued as more and more people figure out more and more ways to earn miles, and there are fewer ways to redeem them for what you actually want, as opposed to what the airlines want you to redeem the miles for. For example, do you really want to spend 6,000 miles for a magazine subscription? Do the math. You just spent $3,800 for a magazine. Do you really want, the one that lingers that cracks me up is for about 6,000 miles, Delta will let you redeem those miles for a box of Godiva chocolates. Now, the box of Godiva chocolates retails for under $40. There are only 18 pieces of chocolate in that box. If 54% of all mileage earned is earned on the ground by, let's say, credit card purchases, that means, in real dollar terms, you spent over $3,300 for a box of chocolates. Divide 18 into that, enjoy your bonbons. Whoa! So you still want to use your miles for the reason why you joined the program in the first place, and that's to go somewhere. You just got to figure out a different way to do it. And the other different way that most people don't know about is the RTW ticket. That stands for Round the World. Now, the price disparity in this, whether you're purchasing the ticket or even using miles, is pretty amazing. If you wanted to use your mileage for a business class ticket, let's say from New York to Hong Kong, where I am right now, you'd almost have to basically get rid of, if they redeemed your miles, for about 250,000 miles. That's a lot of miles. However, if you call the RTW desk, Round the World desk at One World, the One World Alliance, or the Star Alliance, or the Sky Team Alliance, guess what happens? You can do the same trip, stopping in many different places around the world as long as you go in the same direction, for 150,000 miles. And the same thing applies if you wanted to buy the ticket. To buy a ticket around the world, you're talking $28,000, $29,000. But the Round the World ticket, by the way, same flight, same airplane, same seats, same lack of food, just kidding. Guess what? It's about, you know, $6,000. So there are ways to do this. You just can't go the traditional one-dimensional approach. So bottom line is, your New Year's resolution right now is that the mileage program can't. It just cannot scientifically, if you run the numbers, get better for you. It can only get worse. More different ways to earn miles. That actually earns the airlines more money, and less ways to be able to redeem them. So if you are the Chamber of Commerce of Des Moines, boy, have I got news for you. There are people coming to visit that you had no anticipation about. So get your photographs of the beach ready there, which of course doesn't exist. But bottom line, you don't have to do. You have to redeem your miles now. Get the word later out of your vocabulary, because anytime you use that word in a sentence, you don't need to do it as well. You don't do it at all. And that's what the airlines are hoping for right now, because there are, ready for this, almost 18 trillion unredeemed miles out there. Ooh. All right, get up and do what you got to do. We'll be back with more of the Ritz-Carlton in Hong Kong with Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after these messages.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
MedJet Assist. If you're injured or hospitalized while traveling, MedJet Assist will arrange medical transportation directly to the hospital of your choice. Travel safely and be smart. Get MedJet Assist. Take trips, not chances.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
18 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg with you here from the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Hong Kong, the tallest hotel in Asia. The 116, you heard me, 116th floor of the Ritz-Carlton in Hong Kong. Taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter at petergreenberg.com. We with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. And as I do every week at this time of the show, I encourage you to go to our website with the imaginative name, petergreenberg.com, for our comprehensive list of all the aid and relief organizations doing all that hard and essential work in Haiti, in Japan, in Western China, in Chile, and in Christchurch in New Zealand, all of those locations, victims of either earthquakes and or tsunamis in the last almost 2 years. Hard to believe. And as I always tell you, the rebuilding efforts in both Japan and Haiti are going to take quite some time. The good news is when you go to that list and see all the different places where you can actually get involved and craft your own volunteer vacation, it's the best gift you could ever give yourself because you're giving back to others. And for those of you who are listening to the show whose kids are over the age of 8, many of these programs allow you to take your kids as well. Talk about a life-changing experience. So once again, check out the website, petergreenberg.com, for that list. It's perfect for me to be in Hong Kong today because in the airline business, it's very easy to use the old Chinese saying that we live in interesting times. And joining me now is someone who's living in interesting times. He's the chief executive of Cathay Pacific, John Schlosser. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Peter. Glad to be here.
In your time at Cathay, and you've been with the parent corporation for quite some time, but in the almost 1 year that you've been here, we've seen quantum change in the airline business. We've seen a tremendous amount of consolidation. We've seen, and I'm talking industry-wide, of course.
Yes.
We've seen fuel prices go back up again.
Yes.
In this ridiculous roller coaster that you have to survive in and try to actually kind of gauge how you're going to make it. And at the same time, we're seeing, with very few exceptions, for at least in the United States market, airlines finally actually start to make a profit. What happened?
Well, you summarized the environment of the industry pretty well there. I mean, I think the hard thing about aviation is you both have to ride the cycles, short-term cycles up and down of oil price, world economic activity and everything, and at the same time, do the things that long-term are going to make you successful. So, you know, while you're in a downturn, you still got to invest in your product and your service because, you know, before long it will be an upturn. You've got to give people a reason to come back to you.
Well, in the cyclical nature of the business, you know, the time to, I would think, and laugh if you want, the time to order new planes is when you have no money. I mean, because you want to get ready for it.
Actually, the best time to order planes is when the manufacturers have no money. But it tends to happen more frequently that we have no money.
Which explains the American Airlines deal.
It does in a way, indeed.
It really does. I mean, what a great deal. We're going to they made this announcement. In fact, I broke the story on CBS. The largest aircraft order in the history of aviation, blah,
indeed.
Blah, 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 blah. And, well, who's financing it? And then, oh, well, now I understand it.
Well, exactly right. I mean, as always with buying airplanes, you need to be willing to buy them when they're not selling many and all that. So one of the hard things about the business is always being countercyclical. You know, you always need to do the thing that you don't want to do at that time, but that's what you have to do to be successful.
All right, so you beg the question, what is it that you're doing now that you don't want to do?
Well, 2009 was an interesting example. I mean, it was a really difficult year. For us, premium travel, which is one of our core travel segments, really dropped off. And we had to make big decisions about future product development. We wanted to develop a new business class seat and enhance our cabins. We thought that's what we were going to do long term. And I had to go to the board and ask for a bunch of money when they really didn't have very much. But they supported me. And now when things get better, you know, we have the new product and we think it's going to do great things for our bottom line and certainly our top line for sure.
And it's interesting because if you look at the history of Cathay, and I go back quite a ways with Cathay, I always looked at it as an excellent airline, but I initially only looked at it as a Hong Kong airline.
Yes.
Now I've changed. As the airline has changed, I look at you as a global airline that happens to be based in Hong Kong. Is that a better idea?
That's very much how we look at it. I mean, when I joined Cathay some years ago, we had 15 airplanes and really flew exclusively around Asia. But now we are very much global and worldwide.
I remember one night I was in Taipei trying to get to Hong Kong, and they said Hong Kong was closed, and nobody was flying to Hong Kong. Except Cathay, because and I said to them why, and they said because the pilots are based there, they know the airport better than anybody, so we're going to let them go. So okay, I'll get on that plane, and that's how I came to Hong Kong. I wasn't supposed to be on Cathay; that was my first flight. And obviously, we landed. Here I am.
You know. Sure, and that was probably
Kai Tak.
That was at the old Kai Tak airport.
And for those of my audience who don't understand Kai Tak, it was the last of the great wild rides, because you would come into an approach. They had no instrument landing system there; it had an instrument guidance system. And what that meant was you'd get down to like 675 feet and you have to look, and you really had to look sometimes, for this hill with an orange and white checkerboard. And the minute you saw the checkerboard, you had to make like a 25-degree bank immediately or you'd miss the runway. And you'd be threading yourself through downtown Kowloon, And if you were lucky enough to sit on the right side of the plane, right, John? If you were lucky on the right side of the plane,
exactly.
You could look out and see what people were having for dinner. I mean, it was crazy.
The thing about it, though, if you talk to the pilots, and it's always interesting to talk to the pilots, they love doing that approach.
Because they were flying the plane.
Because they were flying the plane. It's much more interesting than a 250-mile straight-in approach. And they all sat up. They were ready to go. And
it was an airport that got your attention.
It was an airport that got your attention. And by and large, was very safe.
I remember another story, and maybe you were around for that one, where I think it might have been Air China put one in the water. It was a 747.
They did. It was off the end of the runway.
Yes.
Yep.
And I remember that story because he didn't start his turn fast enough, and by the time he got lined up for the runway, he was landing too long, and he literally ran out of runway and put it in the bay. And luckily, nobody was injured seriously, and nobody was killed. And here was this brand new 747-400 sitting at the end of that runway on the water. And I'll always remember it with the tail sticking up, right? And I don't know who did it, but they dynamited the tail. They blew the tail off because they claimed it was a hazard to navigation.
It was, indeed. Yeah. You had to do that.
I know.
But, I mean, it just underscores, in aviation, how important safety is. I mean, it's something we take very seriously every day and something you work very hard at, day in, day out, big things and little things, because safety is a combination of both.
What's the one thing that's changed in the airline business that you actually think is a good idea?
Airline business is full of change all the time. Most of the changes are not good ideas.
That's why I asked that question.
But we think in terms of the value that customers get these days is better than it's ever been before. I mean, if you're a business class traveler, you now get a fully flat bed. If you're a road warrior, you're traveling around the world.
And by the way, you say fully flat bed. When they first came out with business class seats, they said they were lie flat beds. They were flat lies because they were not lie, right? Now that's
correct. They are now fully flat. In fact, they're angled at about 4 degrees. So when you're flying, where the nose flies 4 degrees up, they're actually flat. But a road warrior who's going to arrive somewhere has to get off the plane, take a quick shower, and go right into action. That's a big difference for him. So business class has never been better. First class has never been better. In economy class now, you've got a choice of 150 movies, 250 television shows on Cathay. You've got 888 compact discs loaded on our in-flight entertainment
system.
But
who's counting?
So if you can't find something to listen to, then you must have really eclectic taste.
Or either that or this is one really long flight.
It's one really long flight. I mean, remember the old days where you would take your kids on a long flight, and after about 20 minutes, it's kind of, are we there yet? Now you plug them in, put them on the Disney Channel, and they're, quiet as anything for a very long time. So most parents tell me that in-flight entertainment is the best thing that's ever been developed.
Of course, because you're now their babysitter.
Absolutely. And a pretty good one, too.
What about the change that you don't like?
Well, aviation is is one of the most competitive businesses on the landscape, I think. And you can see that in terms of the general poor returns to capital that they've made over time. I think Warren Buffett once...
Well, actually, it was Robert Crandall. We did a special on American Airlines. I couldn't believe he said this on the air. I did the interview with him. He said, let me tell you something. The airline business is a bad business. He said, they haven't made back their capital investment since the Wright brothers. That's what he said to me. I said, you can't be serious. He says, oh, I'm dead serious.
It's a difficult business to run in that score. It's very good for the customers because most of the benefits are passed back to the customers. And that's what's driven, the global travel boom that we've been seeing lately worldwide, but especially out here in Asia.
Crandall said to me, the guys who make the engines make money, the guys who make the seats make money, the guys who make the catering, trolleys make money, the guys who make the tires make money. The airline doesn't make money.
That's right. It's very, very competitive business, lots of innovation, lots of really tight pricing, lots of pressure on costs. It's not an easy business to run, and Bob Crandall would know a lot about that.
And look, you still have your job. It's amazing.
We still have our job. We work very hard at it. And again, I think one of the great benefits we have is being here in Hong Kong. We are, glued to China.
And when we come back, I want to talk about China and all the things that we have to talk about. The big news in China is that it's expanding at such a rapid and exponential way. I mean, China is growing at such an exponential rate. It's hard for you to even try to track it, isn't it?
Well, it is, but I mean, it's going to be the great travel story of this decade, I think. The number of Chinese people who are, having the money to travel and who have the desire to travel is just expanding exponentially.
They've gone from an export economy to a consumption economy, and they want to display it.
Absolutely. In fact, they're going to a balanced economy, which is even better, because that's going to be good for countries that are receiving Chinese goods, but also countries that are exporting to China.
And when we come back, we're going to talk to John a little bit later in the show about the impact of China, because they are really the 500-pound canary. And they are flying. We'll be back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide from the 116th floor, hard to even say that, of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel here in Hong Kong. If you're afraid of heights, don't come. If you're not afraid of heights, you got a great view. Back right after this.
To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit petergreenberg.com. The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now. So call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. Once again, here's your host, Peter Greenberg.
33 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg coming to you from the Ritz-Carlton high above Hong Kong at about 116 stories, taking your calls at about 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter at petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. For those of you who've never been to Hong Kong, let me explain something to you. It's 235 islands, not just one. And it's spread out over a lot of area, over a lot of square miles. The land developed less than 25%. And yet, over the last maybe 20 years that I've been coming here, the actual expansion skyward, as exemplified by the Ritz-Carlton, has certainly been almost exponential. And what that calls into question, of course, is not just Hong Kong exploding in terms of population or popularity, but also design, cutting-edge architecture, and innovation. And joining me now, somebody who knows a little bit about that, is a designer himself, someone who started a company called GOD, which, no, he's not taking himself seriously as a religious entity. It actually stands for Goods of Desire. His name is Douglas Young. Hey, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Hi. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for being here. I mean, I've been coming to Hong Kong since 1978, and, wow. And I'm still amazed at how manageable this location is, how it works so well. And there's a sort of a combination of old school, where there's everything like from the Star Ferry, still works, right?
Yes, absolutely.
To where we are right now. I mean, I don't know about you, but I never would have thought I'd see a 118-story building where it is right now.
Absolutely. I mean, this is amazing, huh? I mean, before, because we had the airport right in the middle of town.
Well, that was the old airport at Kai Tak.
That's right. We weren't allowed to build high. Now that the airport's been moved out to the outlying islands,
then all bets are off.
Everybody's building high, and this is by far the highest building in Hong Kong.
The one thing I do miss about the airport, the old Kai Tak, it was the wildest ride into town
Absolutely.
Ever. If you were sitting on the right side of the plane on the approach and you looked out the window, you know this. You were threading through apartment buildings. You could literally look out the window and see what
That's
somebody
right.
was eating for dinner.
Fantastic, wasn't it?
I would tell my friends, look, when you book the flight, sit on the right side of the plane, and then I'd watch them start to inhale.
Yeah.
They'd look out the window and go, oh my God, you know, right?
Absolutely. Imagine the people living downstairs as well, you know, where their laundry is almost picked up by the wingtips as the plane comes in.
There was a wonderful shot. National Geographic, many years ago, got permission from Cathay Pacific, and they mounted a special wide-angle lens on the vertical stabilizer of an L-1011 on the approach to Hong Kong as it was coming over the buildings.
Yeah.
And so you had this incredible panorama of the buildings below the plane, and it looked like the plane was literally sitting on top of the buildings. It was an amazing photograph.
That's right. But that kind of image is kind of pretty scary nowadays after what happened, you know, not so long ago.
Exactly.
The tall buildings.
Exactly. So whole different deal.
A little bit scary. Yes.
And yet this building is taller than the World Trade Center.
Absolutely. Actually, yes, I think so. Actually, I think we're actually physically taller than the World Trade Center, even though we're maybe on the same level floor-wise, but nowadays the floors are a lot higher, you know, per floor than before.
So what's really changed in terms of the design and the architecture here in Hong Kong, other than just taller buildings?
Actually, I think it's just sort of gone to the worst because, you know, for me, I'm a big advocate of local design because I think, you know, as Hong Kong becomes more and more modern, I think it's actually just becoming more and more Western. You know, a building like this, which is kind of a glass building, glass block box, really, could be really in New York or LA or London or anywhere in the world. I'm a big advocate for more local architecture because I think Hong Kong is sort of losing its real Chinese identity, actually.
Well, I go back to the days of the old Repulse Bay Hotel when they tore it down. Just about.
Yes,
I'm going, oh, don't do that, you know. It was so perfectly, you know, colonial in that respect.
Yeah, that's very endemic of Hong Kong, the mentality, in that when everything has become old and sort of, you know, not useful anymore, they tear it down and they build from scratch, you know. And I'm hoping that that sort of mentality will eventually change, because I think we need to recycle. We need to be more environmentally aware. We need to treat our heritage a lot more respectfully.
Well, for someone listening to the show who's not been to Hong Kong before, or even for somebody who has, what would you suggest that they look for when they come here so that they get a chance to see some of the things that are still existing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think they should go to the less touristy areas. To the areas, I mean, actually, in this part of Kowloon, just some of the back streets are very interesting, I think, you know, where real local people live and how they eat and how they shop. I mean,
well, we're on the Kowloon side, and there's Hong Kong Island across from us.
Yeah.
But most people who come over to the Kowloon side never really get beyond Nathan Road, do they?
Absolutely. I mean, the Nathan Road's just nowadays a tourist trap because it's just full of the big brand
I finally figured out Nathan Road. Ready for this? 8,500 camera stores, one distributor. They're all dealing with the same guy.
Absolutely. So you think you're having a bargain from one shop, but they're actually all by the same guy.
It's one guy named Vern or something. He's got the one distribution thing going because it's the same
guy. That's it, yes. That's why you should just be a little bit more adventurous and go off the beaten track and go to the back streets, you know, where the real local people shop and experience the real Hong Kong.
And by the way, the mass transportation system here in Hong Kong, whether it's the bus or the MTR, yeah, it is so easy to navigate that you should do that.
Yeah.
And I would just take, in the old days, I would take the MTR as far as I could go out to the new territories, you know.
That's right. Yeah.
That's the
way
to do
it. Wow, you're a real old Hong Kong hand.
Ah.
How many times have you been here?
You don't want me to tell you that. You don't want me to tell you that. But what?
78, right?
Yes. Wow. Oh, yeah.
You must have witnessed all the major changes.
I did.
Fantastic.
I did. Stay with me, Douglas, because we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to go back to where we really need to go when we come to Hong Kong. We'll be back with Douglas Young and more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide from the brand new high Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Hong Kong right after this.
Call now to talk to Peter Greenberg at 1-888-887-3837 or email him at peter@petergreenberg.com. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
MedJet Assist. If you're injured or hospitalized while traveling, MedJet Assist will arrange medical transportation directly to the hospital of your choice. Travel safely and be smart. Get MedJet Assist. Take trips, not chances.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
43 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from the Ritz-Carlton in Hong Kong, high above Hong Kong, I should add. And we've been talking with Douglas Young, who started a company called G-O-D, stands for what?
Actually, it's a Chinese name. It's G-O-D. It means live better in Cantonese, but it just happens to sound like G-O-D in English.
Goods of Desire.
Goods of Desire, yeah.
Well, when we talk about, you know, for people coming to Hong Kong, we were just talking about that before we went to the break, about what they should look for. And you said, you know, walking the back roads,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely, yeah.
People, but, you know, when people first come here, they're the iconic things they want to go see. They want to go to the Peak.
Yep. They want to come here to the Ritz-Carlton, yep. 110th floor.
No, don't say 110th floor because we're on the 116th.
Okay, well, the view from here.
Okay,
this,
I got you. Yeah,
hotel is just fantastic, right?
Yeah.
So,
but what else that you would say to them as a visitor? You got to do this. Give me one of those great local ideas.
I think you've got to take a boat. A lot of people don't realize that actually Hong Kong is one of these rare cities in the world where you can be right in the middle of downtown, and then like 10 minutes later, you could be on a beach. You know, you could be on an island by yourself.
Yes, go to Lantau, go to Chung Chau. Go to Chung Chau on the weekends when everybody goes to visit their dead relatives at the cemetery and they bring lunch.
Yeah, or even on a weekday, even better,
yes,
right?
Oh, yeah, because it's quiet. Because it's quiet.
Absolutely.
And the same thing applies to a little island called Lama, right?
Yes, Lama. Lama is great.
Which is, to me, I think it's cool. You get this is not what you do with yourself. You get about 10 of your friends together if you can, rent a boat, and go there for dinner because it's all fish.
Seafood, yes, absolutely. The world's freshest seafood because it's just fresh from the catch. And they show the fish whilst it's still alive in front of you, and then 5 minutes later, it's been deep-fried.
I like that. And the ride there, if you go around 5 o'clock in the afternoon in the summer, maybe 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the winter this time of the year,
absolutely,
it's great.
Well, you don't need to ask me, Peter. You seem to know all the answers.
No, you brought up
you've lived here before.
You brought up the boat. I had to throw it in there, right?
Yeah, but I think going on the boat, going on the sea is an absolute must.
And if you don't want to go to Lama, the cheapest form of first-class transportation is the Star Ferry.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The Star Ferry is great. I mean, especially at night when you cross from Kowloon side, you know, Tsim Sha Tsui, over to Central, which is downtown, the just watching the lights, especially if you cross around 8 o'clock when they switch on all the lights, it's really one of the most impressive sights of Hong
Kong.
And
my tip, this is where you don't want to go first class. You want to go coach.
Downstairs.
You want to go downstairs where it's open and you... Oh, it's...
That's right. Well, you have all the insider's tips.
Stop it!
That's right. Because if you go downstairs, you don't have the... You're not separated by glass. It's completely open and you can really appreciate even the smells of the sea, you know? It's fantastic.
In terms of preserving Asian heritage and culture and the design stuff that you do, give me an example of one of your products that speaks to that.
Well, we actually take a lot of inspiration from things that people see every day but are just completely blind to because they're just so used to it. For me, one of the most iconic things of Hong Kong is the architecture, you know, the traditional buildings of Hong Kong. But I'm not talking about village houses. I'm talking about these multi-story buildings where every window is different because people sort of like modify it or just personalize it, basically. And it's sort of like a multi-level patchwork. I don't know if you've seen the film Blade Runner, which around 20 years ago, right? And that was actually supposed to be Tokyo, but actually I think that was actually Hong Kong, you know, the Yamate district of Hong Kong, where it's always dripping and sort of wet and hot and sweaty. And that's real Hong Kong. And I think an image of that for me is an icon, and I've used that image to inspire my products. You know, I've put that image on handbags, on pajamas, on bed linen, on everything, and it's always been a big hit for us.
And the energy here in Hong Kong, let's not underestimate that. It's high, it's intense.
It is, yes. That's the attraction of Hong Kong. Everybody talks about the energy of this place, you know, that everybody's buzzing around and just nonstop, you know. There's always noise, all this intensity in everything, from smells to, you know, sounds. It's just, there's no other place like it.
And that's what keeps you here.
That's right. I can't imagine being anywhere else but Hong Kong. I mean, New York is pretty close because the energy level in New York is pretty high. But I think New York is much more spread out, whereas here it's a lot more intense.
It is. And the cool thing is you use Hong Kong as your hub when you live here, when you visit, and take day trips anywhere you want to go.
That's right. Actually, we're very well positioned because we're like quite close to places like Japan, China, right next door to China.
Sure.
I mean, even, you know, Southeast Asia, Thailand or Philippines or even Australia. We're right in the middle.
Look, Philippines is a 90-minute flight. Bangkok is 2.5 hours. Right. I mean, it is that close.
Yeah, it is.
Amazing. Douglas Young, designer, architect, the founder of something called GOD, otherwise known as Good to Desire. We're really happy you joined us, man.
Thank you, Peter.
We appreciate that. And we'll come back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide from the 116th floor. It's hard to even believe that we're up this high of the Ritz-Carlton here in Hong Kong right after these messages.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Travel Guard Insurance. For travel insurance plans for the unexpected, see your travel agent or visit TravelGuard.com for affordable travel insurance protection from Travel Guard.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
52 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg coming to you from the Ritz-Carlton, high above, and we're not kidding, high above Hong Kong, and taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. We were just talking with Douglas Young about how Hong Kong is finally trying to get their arms around not just progress for progress's sake, but to preserve the heritage, the culture, and the history of such a rich region. And joining me now is somebody who may be new to Hong Kong, but is embracing that as well, because here we are on the Kowloon side, and there's such a thing called the Kowloon Cultural District. Who knew? And the CEO of the West Kowloon Cultural District is Michael Lynch. Hey, Michael.
Peter, great to be here.
Now, you just came in, right? You're an Aussie.
Yeah, I came in 5 months ago from Australia after a couple of years, most recently there, and then 7 years running the South Bank in London before that.
You know, when I was talking to Douglas, we were saying, you know, most people, when they come to Hong Kong, obviously they're going to come over to the Kowloon side if they're not already staying on this side. and they'll visit Nathan Road and the shops there, and they may go out to the Temple Street Night Market, and they might get on the MTR, they might not. You know, the old days was like, how far could you go to the new territories and all of that. But when you think about it, there's just so much stuff here that you go, wait, don't tear that down, preserve this. You know, like, don't get rid of the ferry building, don't get right, and you have to really work hard for that.
Yeah, I guess I first came here and visited in 64 and then came back in 75 and then have come back regularly.
Okay, when you first came in 64, where'd you stay?
Kowloon. I came on a boat from Australia. Wait,
and I'm going to ask a very inside question. Don't tell me you stayed at the Chung King Mansion.
No, I didn't get off the boat. It was a boat on its way to England and we pulled up at the Kowloon Wharf just around the corner.
Really?
And so my first impressions of this place are, you know, where we are today, except that, you know, we're 116 floors in the sky.
Right. No, that was 1964. We're talking almost, 45 years ago.
Yeah, a very long time ago. Yeah. I'm an old man. And so coming back to take on, you know, this rather awesome responsibility of building a cultural district in Kowloon is interesting challenge, you know, so exciting. But you do feel as though you're pretty close to the centre of the world. And having worked mostly in Australia and then in the last 7 years in the UK, it's been a great opportunity to come and do something differently.
But, you know, in the traditional sense, I won't even say the traditional sense, in the last 40 years, Hong Kong didn't define growth as basically preserving heritage. It defined growth for growth's sake.
Yeah, I guess the buildings is one of the real issues. There's, you know, sort of holding on to their heritage buildings, I think, has been a battle. And that's been, you know, one of the challenges. And then, you know, what we're doing is actually an empty 40 hectares of empty land underneath this hotel that we're going to build 17 new cultural venues, including a museum that's bigger than MoMA in New York and 16 others to cater to, you know, the future audiences that will want to come here.
You mentioned 40 hectares. A hectare is about, what, something like 2 acres.
Two acres, yeah.
Okay, so you're dealing with 80 acres. 80 acres in Hong Kong is unimaginable that it would even be available. So you got smart by going underground.
Well, no, we're not going underground. We're going to going underground to put the cars there.
Yeah.
But it is actually probably the most single valuable site. But it was owned by the government. They reclaimed it 20, 30 years ago. And then the government have given us a large bag of money to realize this project. And, you know, it's going to be, you know, a fantastic addition over the course of the next 7 or 8 years that we build it.
And the biggest innovations you actually plan for parking?
Well, we go under the ground so that, you know, it's got a 23-hectare park on it for people, and parks are a very rare thing
in
Hong Kong.
Although if you get a chance in the morning on the other side, on the Hong Kong side, go to Victoria and watch everybody do their Tai Chi early in the morning. But it's still a small park, though.
Yeah, and this will be, you know, a pretty big park, not big by New York standards, but big by, you know, sort of this city standards. So that'll be about half of the whole space. And then the buildings, the new cultural spaces, bars, restaurants, that'll all be the rest of it.
But it's nice to see that you're going to have a combination of green space and cultural.
Yeah, well, that's what I think very much the intention was, to fuse it as a public space for people, to make it work, get people to be able to hang out there, which is, you know, not one of the easy things to have. And, you know, it's the most fantastic harbour. And so to be able to, you know, engage with the water, to be able to see and touch the water will be, you know, another important part of it. And it's, you know, it's completely surrounded by water.
And, you know, I know you're a relative newcomer here, but let's see if you agree with this. In my entire experience of coming to Hong Kong, I find very few places where I can actually go and sit.
This will be almost, it's almost impossible to sit down, have a meal, have a drink by the water. You're either looking at it from... walking by it. Or, you know, that's where I think the Star Ferry probably, you know, conjures up all sorts of imaginative sights for people, because, you know, that's the only time you really get to get really close to it. So we're incredibly fortunate to have it, you know, so close, and to be able to use it as part of the way we recreate the space.
Well, it's a great project, an ambitious project, and 80 acres, unbelievable. I love it. Michael Lynch, the CEO of the West Kowloon Cultural District, thanks for joining us.
Great pleasure.
We appreciate that. Music means we're out of time for this hour. For those stations leaving us, have a great rest of your weekend, and of course, Mary, Mary. And for those stations sticking around, you're lucky enough to know that we've got a whole lot more coming from the top of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel here in Hong Kong, back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after these messages.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Visit our website at www.petergreenberg.com. Live from around the world, it's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one frontline travel news journalist. Get on the phone now and call 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, the travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Peter Greenberg with you, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. You know where we are? Well, get out your maps, boys and girls. 22 degrees, 15 minutes north, 114 degrees, 10 minutes east. We're coming to you from Hong Kong, specifically at the 116th story of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, way up above. Talk about a room with a view. Amazing stuff. And here's a surprise for you, or maybe not. Airfares, year over year, up about 19 and sometimes as much as 21% over last year. So is it a surprise to you that as airfares go up and the economy is still not going great, guess who's driving? Well, we are. That's right. Bus travel on the rise, whether it's Greyhound or Megabus or Peter Pan. In many cases, we're talking not just a little bit of an increase in ridership. How about 70% increase in riders throughout the Midwest and Northeast system of these bus lines? Pretty amazing. And it's not surprising when you consider the fact that the airfares compared to the bus fares, ridiculously low on the bus fare side. Megabus is still advertising certain fares that start at $1 on the internet. Of course, not every seat on every bus. But the point is, those fares are attracting a whole lot of other people, especially on short-haul flights or short-haul routes. And what's interesting about that is, yes, the fares are down. Yes, the ridership is up. However, and we'll be doing this as a piece on the CBS News very soon, what about bus safety standards? I just thought I'd throw that out there. What about training standards for the drivers? What about rules for how many hours they need to sleep before they get on the bus to drive it? A lot of stuff just isn't there or isn't being enforced. And so I'm just throwing that out there. I'm not pointing fingers at any one bus company. But how about this? Seat belts. How many buses are actually equipped with seat belts? They make you wear them on the plane. Why not on the bus? Especially when you consider that a lot of buses, the construction standards of those buses are not too thrilling. When you consider that they're not properly rollover proof, meaning crumple-proof roofs on buses. Where are the roll bars? Where are the supports? And where are the federal safety standards? Where are the state safety standards for intrastate buses, as opposed to just the ones that cross state borders? So we'll be working on that story. But the good news is, if you're just price sensitive, bus travel, the way to go. Bus travel also the way to go for a number of former American Airlines executives who no longer have their jobs. I think they took the bus as well. I said it before, and I've said it over the last couple of weeks. I'll say it again now. Here's an airline, the last remaining legacy carrier that did not file for bankruptcy, that did not merge. Well, they've done one of those two things now. They filed for bankruptcy, and I'll make you the other prediction. They will merge, or they will be absorbed. Hard to believe it, because the words American Airlines are, I mean, that you can't get more iconic a brand as a flag carrier. I would bet my career on the idea that they're going to start shrinking in the Caribbean because they don't get enough yield there. And even though they're going to be getting some new airplanes, bottom line is that, listen to this, on 40 of its top routes, American's business fares dropped 4% this year, whereas Continental's rose 7% and Delta's rose 13%. What does that tell you about where American was making or losing money? They were discounting to try to get the one passenger they desperately needed, business traveler. So bottom line here, you're going to see a smaller airline You're going to see an airline cutting back on routes that they already have, reallocating their planes to what they perceive to be more profitable routes. And then, isn't it interesting that the one airline that might come after them is the one airline over the last few years that tried to come after everybody? U.S. Air. Remember, they tried to merge with Delta? They tried to merge with everybody. Well, they only have about 8% of market share in the United States. However, they're in a healthier position for the moment than American Airlines is. I mean, imagine American Airlines only having a market cap of about $600 million. That's nothing considering the size of that airline. U.S. Air, with only 8% of the market share, could be in a perfect position to take over American to save itself as well. Being a standalone these days is not a healthy position to be in. And my prediction, whether you like it or not, and by the way, I don't think there's any reason to like it, is that within 3 years, we won't be flying airlines. We'll be flying alliances. We'll be flying Oneworld. We'll be flying Sky. We'll be flying Star. Branding won't be important if you only have a couple of airlines left. It'll be an oligopoly that will control gates, that will control slots, and sorry, folks, they will control fares. Anytime you see the airlines with one of those charges that make you want to opt out of something, do it, because otherwise you've opted in, number one. And number two, force them to make their case. Force them to explain to you what the fees are, because every airline wants to be competitive on rate. How many of them are competitive on value? And not too many of them are competitive on the truth. So there you have it. But bottom line is, you have every right in the world to demand transparency. And then if you want to pay the bag fee, you go ahead and pay it. Or do what I do. Remember, there are only two kinds of airline bags, carry-on and lost. And on domestic flights, do what I've always done. I FedEx or UPS my bags 3 days ahead, ground service. And for about $20 more than the airline wants to charge me for losing my bags in the first place, guess what? I get door-to-door service, and I save at least an hour and a half, if not 2 hours of my life, by not schlepping that stupid bag. Simple as that. And in a very practical way, another way that's going to save a lot of money, it's going to save a lot of time, it's going to save a lot of fuel, it's going to stop a lot of misconnected passengers and misconnected bags, is to make pre-clearance the rule, as opposed to the exception, at major international airports around the world where Americans fly. It's wonderful to have pre-clearance for customs in Ireland, in Bermuda, in the Bahamas. It works like a charm. You actually clear U.S. customs before you even get on the plane, so that when you get to where you need to go in a U.S. airport city, a gateway city, guess what happens? Your bags connect. You don't have to go through customs. You don't have to worry about if your bags are going to make the next flight or whether or not your plane's going to be delayed because everybody else is at customs at the same time you are. You do it in London, you do it in Paris, you do it in Rome, you do it in those major international gateway cities where you're talking about real volume, where people have to come to the airport early anyway. And guess what? You're saving time, money, effort, stress, all right? And don't make me pay a pre-clearance charge either, because we are saving you money. I'm saving you money. And the proof is in the pudding. Ask the folks who've traveled from Ireland to back to the United States if they appreciate saving an hour and a half of their lives by pre-clearing U.S. customs there. It's a no-brainer. And what a great way to welcome visitors to the United States than by welcoming them this way, as opposed to standing in the world's longest line at Miami, or in Chicago, or in Dallas, or in L.A. All right, I'm done on that one, because when we come back, we're going to be talking about Hong Kong and a lot of things you should be doing in the next coming year. When we come back to the Ritz-Carlton Hong Kong, Peter Greenberg Worldwide gets back with you right after this. And we're going to talk about what happens when you travel for medical reasons right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Travel Guard Insurance. For travel insurance plans for the unexpected, see your travel agent or visit TravelGuard.com for affordable travel insurance protection from Travel Guard.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
18 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg with you here from the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Hong Kong, the tallest hotel in Asia. And let me tell you something. Your ears pop in the elevator every time you come up in the elevator, and it's just an amazing experience. taller than the World Trade Center. And on the 118th floor, so two floors above us, the tallest pool in the world at a hotel. I mean, so if you're afraid of heights and afraid of water, have I got a hotel for you. But other than that, what an amazing experience. We're joined now by John Schlosser, who was with us earlier in the show, the chief executive of Cathay Pacific. And when we were talking earlier in the show, John, we talked about the impact of China and how that's changing. A good friend of mine who runs your operation out of India, when he first got there might have been like 8 round trips a week between Mumbai and Beijing, and now it's like tripled. Is it really growing that rapidly?
It is, Peter, actually. As Chinese people have income, there's just an innate desire to travel. The Chinese are great travelers. They want to see the world. Anyone you talk to in the street can almost tell you where they'd like to go.
And they've been waiting.
And they've been waiting. And they're ready to go. So we're seeing fantastic travel. Our Dragonair network into China is about 400 flights a week to 17 destinations. We're going to be growing that.
Well, we mentioned destinations. I remember landing in Nanjing not too long ago, and brand new gleaming airport. I was the only airplane on the ground. They had 85 gates. I was the only one there saying, did they evacuate the place and not tell me? No. They were building ahead of it.
Yes, they are.
Which is an interesting way to think about it.
Which is good. Well, they can see the growth coming, and because they can see it coming, they are building ahead of it. I mean, I'm on record as saying, look, I think at the end of this decade, you know, the biggest travel story of the decade is going to be the emergence of China as an international travel market.
And not inbound, but outbound.
Outbound, absolutely. Outbound, absolutely. And they want to go see the world, and they're going to go in droves. And I think it's a great opportunity for all the airlines and hotels and the travel industry of the world. We're certainly planning to take advantage of it.
How many new airports have they built?
They went from a very small number to about 70, and they've got, I think, another 50 coming up over the next 10 years. But I think the interesting thing is I mean, obviously it's a big population in China, but there's a real desire to travel. And that's the interesting thing. That's a great thing for the travel business.
Cathay has always struck me as an airline that doesn't nickel and dime.
No, we definitely don't do that. I mean, we don't think it would fit the Cathay brand at all, and I think the consumers in this part of the world really wouldn't go for that.
I mean, are there any charges? I'll put it another way. Were there charges that you were considering and then went, no, let's not go there because it's just going to backfire?
Well, we looked at what people have been doing, and again, aviation
like the check baggage fees.
Aviation is a business with great innovation. Some of it bad. we would never do check baggage fees.
You just use the never word.
Never maybe during my term. I won't be here forever. But it's just not something that we think would fit the Cathay brand. We're unlikely to charge for meals or any of that kind of thing. We do charge for an exit row seat where you've got basically unlimited space in front of you because it's a better product. But by and large, the Cathay brand is about high quality service start to finish. It's all included in the price, and we still find a lot of takers for that proposition.
Well, I'm a big fan of the word all inclusive if it doesn't include an asterisk. You know, if it really says all inclusive, then it really is. And that way, and people, I think people will actually pay more for that because they don't think they have to go to their wallet every 5 minutes.
Again, I think it ruins the experience. You know, travel should still be a fantastically positive experience, a little bit of glamour in it. You're going
somewhere. Do you still get excited when you get on a plane?
Oh, of course I do. How can you not do when you walk through these great airports out here and you see people going in all directions and rushing along? Who knows what they're going for? Big family reunion, taking their kid to university. There are all sorts of great reasons why people get on airplanes.
I have an admission to make. In the United States, they say you've got to be out at the airport at least 2 hours early because of security, and you go out there, oh, God, do I have to? I will actually get out to an airport in Singapore, at Changi, or here in Hong Kong, or even in Bangkok. I'll get out 3 hours earlier because I want to hang out at the airport. I actually have fun out there.
I do too. I mean, I think it's great. The way that the French sit in cafes and watch people go back and forth, I think you do the same at an airport.
But I have to tell you, John, at your first class club here, right, the Wing?
Yes.
What's my most favorite thing about it? Come on, can you guess?
I would hope either the long bar, which is the world's longest bar.
And what's at the end of the long bar? Come on.
What's at the end of the long bar?
Yeah, I know.
Okay, you got me on that one, Peter. You better let me know.
Haagen-Dazs.
Oh, Haagen-Dazs.
Haagen-Dazs, come on. Right? Those little...
Absolutely, yeah, yes. The little Haagen-Dazs. Okay.
I mean, you can go in there...
You've clearly explored the depths of the lounge. I can see that
Oh,
now.
They that's see me coming.
Good.
That's absolutely...
Yes, okay, that's good.
But that's a cool thing.
Well, we think that, the lounge sets up the travel experience. You get in there, you've probably been rushing to the airport, you've had a hard day, you get a chance to relax, have a drink, maybe have a little bit of food, you're ready to go. So just the idea of making yourself ready to get on the plane, we think is an important part of the travel experience.
What have you done in terms of the in-flight comfort experience in terms of seating? Because every airline will tell you, we have the best, most comfortable seats in the air. We talked about, lie-flat seats.
Peter, we have the best, most comfortable seats in the air.
Oh, stop.
I mean it. And then let me. Our first class is world renowned. Over the last couple of years, we've won the prizes for best first class in the world. There was recently a big blog post that said best travel trip ever, and it was Cathay Pacific first class. We've got a new business class, which is getting rave reviews. You can see it in New York. It's on a couple of the New York flights every day. It's on Chicago. We're introducing premium economy in May 2012, which is going to be a really good premium economy product, a bigger seat, more reclined. But not just hardware. We're going to give a better meal and a welcome drink and all the kind of things that you would like to have. And we're actually going to put a new economy seat in as well, which we think is more comfortable for ultra-long-haul flying.
Is that the economy seat that doesn't literally recline, but kind of cradles down?
That's the one we have now, and we think we can do better than that. With some of the new technology, the composites, we can do something light that's supportive but well-cushioned, and we think everybody's going to appreciate that.
You know, I had to laugh when Singapore Airlines came out with their A380 product and also their long-haul product in both business class and first class, where they have that huge bed.
Yep.
Right? And they held the Singaporeans, I have to say, and with all due respect, they're not known for their sense of humor, and they actually held a press conference. I don't think they even realized how cool this press conference was. They had no idea what they were saying. They held a press conference, and they were very serious about this. They said, "We want to make an announcement that this seat is for one passenger only." Because when you look at that, you go, "I need a significant other with me to fly," when you see the size of this bed.
Well, I think, you know, first class has never been better. I mean, you get more for your money now than you ever have before. It is a fantastic travel experience. It's a life experience almost, I think, taking a long-haul first class, you know, flight, for instance, from Hong Kong to New York City. I mean, a lot of people say...
I mean, between you guys, yeah. Singapore and Emirates, I mean... Who would want to even get off the plane in that compartment?
Well, I often get emails to that extent saying, you know, I enjoyed the trip so much, I didn't want to get off the plane. And, of course, it's always pleasing as a CEO to hear things like that.
See, now, U.S. Airlines, they get emails saying, get me off the plane. you need to know that, you know.
Different market. I mean, a domestic market is different from an ultra-long-haul market.
Sure.
And look, when they compete in the long-haul markets, I think they are understanding that they need to compete, you know, for the traveler. You know, nothing is a given in this business.
Sure.
You have to compete for every traveler who buys a ticket on you, and you've got to give them a good reason to buy your ticket and not somebody else's.
Let me throw this at you. I'm one of those people who actually thinks, and maybe I'm wrong, that 3 years from now we may not be flying airlines anymore. We'll just be flying alliances.
I don't think that's going to happen, personally. I think certainly in One World, we're part of One World, and we have that debate occasionally.
Yeah.
And within One World, we know that the individual airline brands are stronger than the alliance brand. Cathay is a big brand here.
Well, here it is, yes.
British Airways is a very strong brand in Europe. You know, American is a very strong brand in the U.S. LAN is a very big, strong brand in Latin America. Japan Airlines, you know. We don't see the airline brands being subsumed by the alliance brand in the short term.
I mean, right now, I don't know anybody who gets up in the morning saying, I can't wait to fly a One World flight.
Well, neither do I. Yeah. And when I meet one, then I'll start to worry, but I haven't met him yet.
What about routes? I'm a big fan of what I call secret flights, those fifth freedom rights that nobody knows. You know, if you want to fly from Los Angeles to Sao Paulo, who knows that Korean Air flies it nonstop?
Yeah.
You want to fly from New York to Vancouver? That's your flight. Nobody
yes,
would ever think
is.
Cathay flies from New York to Vancouver, but you do. What are some of the secret flights that you know about?
Well, it's one of the most interesting areas of international aviation, in fact, traffic rights. It can be a brutal business. They're like trade agreements. Everybody's looking for a good deal somehow. And, you know, you only get as good as you give at the end of the day. So if you want to get something good, you've got to give something good. So we try to approach that in a positive way. You know, Vancouver, New York is certainly one of our good ones. It's a route that's not served otherwise. We've got a daily 777 on it with pretty good timing. It's international product, so it's much better than you would get.
And you're allowed to take traffic locally.
And we're allowed to take traffic locally. We have traffic rights, for instance, between Thailand and India. We have a bunch of flights between, say, Bombay and Bangkok, Delhi and Bangkok. We have flights in different places around Southeast Asia. But, you know, these days, the way equipment has developed, there's more and more direct flying and less fifth freedom flying, I would say.
Yeah,
That's been a trend. Yeah, I think it, in a way it's a loss to the business. But, you know, more and more people want to get on the plane at one point and get off the plane where they want to go and not have to worry about onward segments and stops and all that. And you can see that the convenience is a driver of consumer preference.
Well, it's time for us to get off the plane.
Absolutely.
John Slosser, the Chief Executive of Cathay Pacific. Thanks for joining us. Really appreciate that. And I'll see you on the secret flight.
Pleasure, Peter.
You got it. We'll be back with more Peter Greenberg Worldwide from the Ritz-Carlton, where you have to get off the flight by taking the elevator down. We'll be back with more right after this.
To To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit petergreenberg.com. The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now. So call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. Once again, here's your host, Peter Greenberg.
33 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg coming to you high atop the Ritz-Carlton. I mean high atop the Ritz-Carlton Hotel here in Hong Kong. Taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. What's one of the fastest growing segments in travel? Volunteer vacations is one of them. One that's even bigger and more intense, medical tourism. And what's amazing about that is how many people who are either not properly insured or underinsured or not insured at all, who are basically seeking out important medical help around the world. We're talking numbers that are growing so rapidly. And we're not just talking about somebody getting plastic surgery in Brazil or liposuction. We're talking about heart surgery, hip replacements. We're talking about kidney operations. We're talking about serious stuff where not only can you get great care overseas, but the quality of care is only superseded in many cases by the cost in terms of the savings. And joining me now, the founder and one of our shows, who's done our show in the past many times, the founder of Patients Beyond Borders, Joseph Woodman. Hey, Joseph.
Hey, Peter. Good to be on again.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers that I'm seeing really are staggering in terms of how many people are traveling purely for medical reasons now.
Yeah, it's growing. Depending on what reports you believe, it's somewhere between 30 and 80%, sometimes even more. There are 5 million medical travelers each year heading to something like 80 destinations to
sure.
take advantage of price savings and quality, as you mentioned.
And also, you know, and I also mentioned quality of care. There's a hospital in Bangkok that I know very well because two of my godsons were born there. That hospital is so state-of-the-art and so cutting-edge that, I mean, it's so clean. People who've gone there just swear by it.
It's probably Bumrungrad.
Yes.
And I just returned from Southeast Asia, had two tests, and saved a total of $5,400 over what I would have paid at Duke University Medical Center. Paid for the trip and came on home and lived to tell about it. And you're right, it's totally state-of-the-art. They welcome 25,000 American patients each year.
And you talk about live to tell about it. One of the most important caveats I always tell my friends, and I hope you will weigh in on this, Joseph, is that it's not just the cost savings and it's not just the quality of care. It's also embracing the aftercare. And that is, you can't just like take a vacation, get the operation, and turn around and come home. I mean, you had tests and came around and came home, but I'm talking about a serious decision about having surgery also has to also embrace a serious decision about the aftercare, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And of course, for the more exotic travel involving tens of thousands of miles, aftercare is something that should be handled prior to your trip. And so you should always talk to your attending specialist at home prior to your trip, and you should bring all of your paperwork back, all your consultations, your x-rays, your blood work, your physical therapy and pharma prescriptions. And then doctors are going to be much much happier to deal with you. The good news is the complication rate for medical travelers is, depending on which procedure it is usually lower than what you get in the United States.
Wow, and that's a surprise for most people who hear that for the first time. Now, part of this gets down to accreditation, doesn't it? I mean, 10 years ago, there wasn't really an effective accreditation program to know, am I going to a decent hospital overseas? Now there is.
Truly, and that's been another area of staggering growth. And we began research for Patients Beyond Borders 6 years ago. There were only 28 JCI-accredited hospitals. Now, JCI is the largest accreditor in the world. They're based in the U.S. in Chicago. And they're kind of the good housekeeping seal of approval for hospitals in the United States. They started accrediting international hospitals 10 years ago, and this year they just accredited, this past March, their 400th 400th international hospital. So that means now there's 400 hospitals around the world, whether you're talking about Turkey or Malaysia or Thailand or Mexico or Costa Rica or Panama, where Americans can go and get American-accredited care from board-certified U.S. doctors. Talk about no-brainers.
Is there a particular destination that specializes in one particular form of medical procedure more than others? I mean, if you were to say, if you need to go get a heart transplant, here's where you need to go. If you want liver, here's where you need to go. If you have a kidney problem, here's where you need to go.
Well, those lines are graying a little bit because of the sheer number of large, high-quality hospitals that Americans can choose from. But short answer, yes. India is still very well known for orthopedics and heart surgeries. Singapore, well known for cancers and stem cell replacements. Mexico is rising in terms of bariatrics, and they've always been known for cosmetic surgery and dental care. Thailand, known for its hospitality and just this very huge attention to serving the patient as well as giving them great care. So, yeah, there's
let's not forget
what you're looking for.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And let's not forget that small little town called Algodones on the other side of the border of Yuma, Arizona, where in the winter months up to 15,000 Americans a day literally park their cars and walk across the border to have their dental work done. Unbelievable.
Exactly, exactly. And the same thing is true in Europe, where folks from Germany travel in by the busloads to northwestern Hungary. There's a town, Győr, 160 dental clinics. They stop in Vienna or Salzburg, take in an opera, go get their dental work done, and get on a bus and go back to Germany. So it's really fascinating.
Amazing. Joseph Woodman, the founder of Patients Beyond Borders. You can read more about him, of course, on our website, petergreenberg.com. Joseph, thanks for joining us. Have a wonderful holiday.
Hey, thanks to you. Same to you. Take care.
You got it. When we come back, more from Peter Greenberg Worldwide, high atop the Ritz-Carlton Hotel here in Hong Kong. Back right after this.
Call now to talk to Peter Greenberg at 1-888-887-3837 or email him at peter@petergreenberg.com. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Travel Guard Insurance. For travel insurance plans for the unexpected, see your travel agent or visit TravelGuard.com for affordable travel insurance protection from Travel Guard.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
43 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg coming to you from high atop the Ritz-Carlton Hotel here in Hong Kong, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88 Peter. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem, and we'll solve it right here on the air. You know, I always say if you really want to know about someplace, ask a local, and my next guest certainly qualifies for that. The author of The Lonely Planet Guides, The Hong Kong Encounter 3, China 12, Hong Kong and Macau City Guide number 14. The list is endless. Pierre Chen, how are you?
Hi, Peter. I'm good.
How
you
doing?
Are you?
Good. Well, you know where I am. I'm high atop the Ritz-Carlton, the tallest hotel here, of course. It's crazy.
Yes.
When you're putting together a guidebook like this, I have to just ask you as a local, because people always want to go do the iconic things. They want to go to the peak, or they'll want to go, you know, do the Star Ferry, or they'll maybe go out to Lantau to see the Buddha. What would you tell me to do that's not in any other guidebook except yours, because you're the local, that I should absolutely do?
I'm not sure if it's in other guidebooks or not, but I think the Yau Ma Tei wholesale fruit market is quite unique. But you have to stay up late to go there because nothing happens until like 2 a.m. and lasts
until
6. Yeah.
I like that.
You have these market buildings that have been around for over a century. They're actually listed heritage buildings. And then you see people offloading fruit and trucks, and you know it's just it gets really busy late at night.
I love it. Now, what about designer clothes?
Designer clothes. The Hong Kong fashion scene is not as vibrant as it used to be in the 80s. But if you like, do you want designer clothes? Local designers, you can go to Causeway Bay. And some parts of Soho, or you can, you know, if you like to do the local thing, you can go to Rise Commercial Arcade in Tsim Sha Tsui. And but you have, you know, if you have a good eye, you can end up looking like you're fit for a Vogue photo shoot. Yeah.
Now,
but you have,
I remember coming to Hong Kong the first time in 1978. I'd go up on mm-hmm. Queens Road, go up a flight of stairs or maybe two flights of stairs and do dim sum there in the old way where they'd actually come by with the carts and they count the number of plates.
Yes.
Can you still do that?
Yes. You can still do that. You can do that at Lin Hung. Lin Hung is one of the older yum cha places in Hong Kong. So people come around in those little carts. And the other place is Maxim's City Hall restaurant. It's
yep.
newer, but people also come around in trolleys. And
I love it.
It's just a very typical yum cha experience. A lot of Hong Kongers remember the earliest yum cha experiences as, you know, having been in one of those restaurants.
Now, one of our previous guests on the show, we talked about going to Lama, you know, chartering a boat mm-hmm. with your friends and going out there for a wonderful fish dinner. But there's also going to Lama mm-hmm. the scary way.
Oh, the scary way? What scary way?
Ah, go to Lama. Well, if you don't get the ferry, what about the sampans? Are still going to go? That are still going to get you out there?
Oh, the sampans. Yes, I'm sure. I mean, if you're willing to pay the price, I'll do it. Yeah, but I haven't done that. I know you can hire a sampan to take a tour of the Aberdeen Typhoon Shelter. Yes, I know you can do that. But Lama, I haven't.
Now, of course, the star ferry that most of the people take goes between Central and Kowloon, but there are so mm-hmm. many other ways to use that ferry, aren't there?
Yes, I think they canceled some of the routes, actually, Peter, but I think, I'm not sure if they still do the Wan Chai Kowloon one. They used to. But it's probably been canceled quite recently. Yeah.
But you can take the Star Ferry to some of the other islands.
You can't. No, you can't. The Star Ferry is right next to the outlying ferry terminals now because it moved.
Right.
And then
I know I'm still upset that they moved the terminal. I used to love going just down from the Mandarin Oriental downstairs under the tunnel to the Star Ferry terminal and just taking it across to Kowloon. Now you have to walk a long time.
Right, and it doesn't look the same. It's just not the same.
Okay. Last question for you. Last one. Where do you like to eat that's not in the guidebook? Where do you like to hang out?
Where do I like to hang out that's not in the guidebook? Let me think. I like to go to Kowloon City. I like to check out what is in my guidebook. I like to check out the restaurants.
Yes. I think I've lost you there.
Yes.
You know what? There you are. I hear you. Stay with me a second, Piero, because we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to hear the answer to that question. You left us hanging. You got a little bit of time to think about where you like to hang out. We'll be right back.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
MedJet Assist. If you're injured or hospitalized while traveling, MedJet Assist will arrange medical transportation directly to the hospital of your choice. Travel safely and be smart. Get MedJet Assist. Take trips, not chances.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
It's 52 minutes after the hour. Peter Greenberg here with you from high atop the Ritz-Carlton Hotel here in Hong Kong. Here's a statistic you probably didn't know. Hong Kong has more Rolls Royces per person than any other city in the world. Wow. There's something you just heard from me, but we've been talking to Piero Chen, who does a lot of the Lonely Planet guidebooks. And right before the break, Piero, we were talking about where do you like to hang out? Where do you like to eat that may not be in the guidebook?
Okay. I'd like to go to Fanling or Shangshou to try out the Walled Village cuisine at some of the restaurants and combine that with maybe a tour of the walled villages of Hong Kong, which are the homes of the earliest clans that settled here. I also like to go to Aberdeen, the Typhoon Shelter, or Ap Lei Jiao, which is just right across the channel, and have cheap fresh seafood at one of those places where the dragon boaters and the fishermen go. And
it's interesting because so many people, you know, like to say, oh, I don't really want to eat on the street. I don't think it's safe. I disagree. I think as long as it's cooked, you
it's
can eat
safe.
It.
Yeah, it's very safe.
I agree. And you talk about the walled city. You're talking about the going way out to where the new territories used to be, right?
Walled villages, not walled cities. Yeah, walled villages. There are walled villages in the new territories. I definitely think tourists should check those out. There is the Ping Shan Heritage Trail. That's the earliest and the oldest heritage trail in Hong Kong. And you can go inside the walled villages, and they have very nice ancestral halls, and they have scholar studies and, you know, all these really unique things. And you can combine that with, you know, a meal at one of these walled village restaurants cooking walled village cuisine, rather. Yeah.
Got it. And when you say about eating inexpensive seafood, what kind of food are we talking about? I mean, give me an idea of what you would order.
Okay. In Atlee Jiao, there is actually a place right above a wet market that you can you can go to the wet market and pick out all the seafood you want. You can have, you know, fish that you normally wouldn't find in other markets. You can have nice prawns. You can have clams and razor clams and, you know, these unique things. And then at a very reasonable price, you just pick out what you want, and then they will take it up to the restaurant, which is kind of like a dai pai dong, like an open-air stall, except that it's not, you know, it's inside a building. And you go up there, and they'll, you know, you go to a specific vendor, and they'll cook it for you, you know, for a very cheap price. And then all the dragon boaters, because Atlee Jiao and Aberdeen are places where the Hong Kong fisher folk used to be, the boat dwellers, the tanka people. And so you have 9 months of the year, you see people practicing in the typhoon shelter, practicing dragon boat. And after that, they, you know, they go to these restaurants and they eat and they drink beer because it's, you know, reasonably priced and the atmosphere is great. But it's very local.
And that's exactly where you want to go. It's sort of like the whole idea of a truck stop in America. You want to go where the truckers hang out. You want to go where the dragon boaters hang out because you know the food's going to be good.
Right. Yep.
All right, so now part of where I define a city, whether it's Hong Kong or Houston, it doesn't matter, is I always ask people to tell me, where do you want to go to simply get lost in a city?
Simply get lost in a city. In Hong Kong, you'd want to go to Mong Kok. But because it's just, you know, because it's just a lot of the same things if you go along Nathan Road, but that is not very interesting. Maybe, you know, you can get lost in Sheung Wan. That would be more interesting, I guess.
All those winding alleyways, right?
Yeah. Because Sheung Wan, Aberdeen Street was where, when the British had racial segregation policy, Aberdeen Street in Sheung Wan was where, you know, where the boundary was. So to the east was where the British lived and the Europeans lived, and to the west was where the Chinese quarter. And Sheung Wan was right smack in the middle of it. And so you get all these coffin makers, funeral shops, dried seafood stores, herbalist shops, and you have some very important temples there. And one of them, Manmo Temple, a very old temple, nice, you know, it's actually really pretty. And it used to serve as a court of arbitration for local disputes because trust was thin between the Chinese and the Europeans, and the Chinese wanted to do everything their own way. And then in the vicinity of Manmo Temple, you have Pak Sing Ancestral Hall, which is also a temple now, but it used to be a clinic for Chinese patients who did not trust Western medicine. And it also used to be a storeroom for bodies awaiting burial in China.
Although I will tell you this,
so
if you go to the temple that you just mentioned, be prepared for an intense immersion in incense.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I know. I mean, just be prepared. You go, wow, there's a lot of incense being burned in here. It's like it's like incense on steroids there, but you definitely have to check it out.
Right.
Piera Chen, the author of Lonely Planet Guides, Hong Kong Encounter 3, China 12, Hong Kong and Macau City Guide 14. Hey, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And that music means we're out of time for this hour. But for those stations leaving us, have a great rest of your holiday weekend. Please don't get stuck at the mall. And for those stations sticking around, we've got a whole lot more coming from high atop the Ritz-Carlton here in Hong Kong on the 116th floor. Back with more Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after this.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Visit our website at www.petergreenberg.com. Live from around the world, it's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one frontline travel news journalist. Around the world, the trip begins with a kiss. Roam if you want to, roam around the world. Get on the phone now and call 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, the travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
I hope you're having a wonderful time wherever you happen to be. Let me tell you where we are, 22 degrees, 15 minutes north, 114 degrees, 10 minutes east. We're coming to you from high atop the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Hong Kong. When I say high atop, we're talking 116 stories high. And let me put this in perspective. If you define a skyscraper, and the traditional description of a skyscraper, believe it or not, it might surprise you, is a building that's more than 14 stories tall, then Hong Kong has the most skyscrapers in the world, at about 8,000 of them, almost double of that of its nearest rival, which is New York. Pretty wild, huh? Amazing stuff. And wow, this particular view is quite phenomenal. And worth it just to come here alone. Lots of emails to talk about today before we get to calls. One from Todd in New York City. My wife and I will be in London for four nights beginning January 10th. The various websites are overwhelming with hundreds of hotels to choose from. We are looking for something under $300 that includes breakfast. We would like to be walking distance to Piccadilly and Buckingham Palace. Do you have any suggestions? Yeah, lots of them. I mean, there are, throughout London, lots of Best Western hotels, lots of Holiday Inns. That will cost you anywhere from 150 to 200 pounds a night, which is exactly within your budget. And remember this, London is as long as you're close to transportation, which is either the tube or the bus, you'll be fine. How much time do you actually spend in your hotel room other than showering and sleeping? Not much. You're not going to be entertaining anybody in there, and that's how you do it. Just check out their website, either the Holiday Inn website or the Best Western. You'll be just fine. And by the way, on the Best Western, you might be surprised, not just in London, but in many other cities in the world, not in the United States, but outside the United States, a Best Western hotel could also be a chateau, it could be a castle, it could be an estate. Completely different definition of terms about what makes a Best Western hotel outside the U.S., and you might be very pleasantly surprised. Here's one from Rod in Miami. Would you point me in the right direction in choosing a credit card that covers travel insurance, medical insurance, rental car loss of use coverage? Is there such a card? Rod, the answer is no. No, there's no one-stop shopping card that's going to give you all of that. The real key is how you're going to use the card and where you're going to travel that will really determine the choice that you make. Meaning, if you're only going to use the card within the United States, then you don't have to worry about what we call the transaction fees. The foreign transaction fees that can go anywhere from 1.5% to 3% of everything you buy. And then if you wanted to choose a card that would cover you on that, well, then Capital One is one of those cards that would help you out because they don't have a foreign transaction fee. Are you going to be using the card, for just getting mileage? What's that going to be about? You do not get a credit card that's going to cover travel insurance or cancellation insurance, medical insurance, even rental car loss of use coverage, because most of those cards have a problem, in my book anyway. They're either offering secondary insurance, not primary insurance. And what that secondary insurance means, it's insurance that only kicks in when the primary insurance is expired. But if you don't have primary insurance to begin with, there is no such thing as secondary insurance. So you always need to ask when a credit card company says to you, hey, if you use our credit card, you're covered. Ask them, are you providing primary insurance from day one? If the answer is no, it's a useless card. Now, you mentioned medical insurance. There are a number of credit cards that do offer medical insurance. And in particular, what we're talking about is not just trip cancellation policies. We're talking about medical evacuation and repatriation insurance. That's key. But you need to ask them to read you the fine print. And the fine print is this. Under their policy, will they fly you to the medical facility and doctor of your choice? not their choice, your choice. And most of these things don't do it that way. They you become part of an auction for the lowest bidder, and you may end up in a bad HMO in Rwanda. The bottom line is always ask if they're going to allow you, under the terms of your policy, to have the doctors consult your doctor. After all, who's got your medical records better than your own doctor? And then fly you back to the medical facility of your choice. One of the ways you can do that on any insurance proposals, whether it's rental car insurance or trip cancellation insurance, is to consult a website called InsureMyTrip.com. That's InsureMyTrip.com, because what they do is they do a policy-by-policy, company-by-company language comparison. They actually read and understand. Now, there's a challenge. They read and understand the insurance policy language in individual policies and can give you a reasonably good chance of discriminating between what works and what doesn't. So always go to InsureMyTrip.com. You get it on the web, of course, and they will give you a good comparison as to what is covered and what isn't. Speaking of that, under no circumstances should you ever travel overseas without medical evacuation and repatriation insurance, even if you're only going once a year, because chances are very high that your own personal medical insurance doesn't cover you once you leave the United States borders. And the cost of flying you back home and treating you and stabilizing you so you can fly back home in situations like that is so excessive. We're talking way into the six figures here. So for a premium of about $350 a year, it's an annualized premium, it's more than worth it to get that kind of coverage, as long as you do what I told you to do in the beginning, and that is to make sure the language says that they will consult with your own personal physician and fly you back to the doctor and medical facility of your choice. Here's one from Chris in San Francisco. Going to the Galapagos Islands and Machu Picchu next March. Any advice? Could you be any more general, Chris? I'll help you out on this one. Make sure that your tour operator that's handling the Galapagos Islands trip is basically part of the government restrictions on limiting the number of people who can go at any one time. You know, it's one thing to sell you a package to Ecuador. It's another thing to get you to the actual Galapagos Islands. Make sure that you're covered on that one. And as far as Machu Picchu is concerned, the question is, how do you want to do Machu Picchu? Do you want to do the four-day hike to the top? Do you want to do a combination of a hike and the train, or you want to just take a fly to Cusco and take the train? If you're a first-timer and you're not in good physical shape, or you're in less good physical shape than you think, I suggest the train. Remember, you're high altitude. Your chances are you're not going to give yourself enough time to adjust to it. And bottom line is, you want to be able to see it in a way that you're not taken out on a stretcher once you get there. So my advice, fly to Cusco, take the train. And my other advice, which people will tell you, oh, you can't do it. Well, the answer is yes, you can. Is get there the night before, get an early night's sleep because you want to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and get out there before the sun ever rises. The key to going to a place like Machu Picchu or the Taj Mahal or the Great Wall of China or the pyramids in Giza is to get out there before the sun rises so you can have that incredible life-changing moment of not being out there with 85 other tour buses and watching the sun come up, and it's just you and maybe three or four other lucky enough people who figured it out as well. So if you want to see Machu Picchu, get a very early day because you want to beat the sun and you want to beat the crowds. And take the train your first time up. You'll thank me, okay? When we come back, we're going to be back to the Ritz-Carlton here in Hong Kong, one of these really big skyscrapers, probably the tallest hotel in Asia, with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Travel Guard Insurance. For travel insurance plans for the unexpected, see your travel agent or visit TravelGuard.com for affordable travel insurance protection from Travel Guard.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
18 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg coming to you from the tallest hotel in the world. We're about 1,600 feet if you actually measure it properly. And what a view. We're taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter at petergreenberg.com with your name, your phone number, your question, and your problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. And as I do every week at this time on the show, I encourage you to go to our website with the most imaginative name on the planet, petergreenberg.com, to get our comprehensive list of all the aid and relief organizations doing all that hard and essential work in some pretty devastated areas of Haiti, of Japan, Western China, Chile, and our friends down in Christchurch in New Zealand, all of them victims of either tsunamis or earthquakes in the last almost 2 years. And the rebuilding efforts there may even take one or two generations, especially in places like Haiti. And as fast as they're moving, even in Japan, it's going to take a while. The cool thing about that list, you'll find yourself pleasantly surprised by it, is how many different things you can relate to. Whether you're the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, it doesn't matter. You've got something to bring to the party. And if you structure a volunteer vacation around that kind of a trip to really help people out, you become the party. And if you've got kids over the age of 8, in many cases, those trips allow you to structure them and include your children. What an amazing lifetime achievement, if you will, and memory for them to be able to be part of that, because the best gift you can give yourself, of course, is when you give back to someone else. Lots of stuff to talk about today. But first, everybody, you know, in the digital age, everybody thinks they're a photographer. In the digital age, everybody thinks that they can take up a camera and get a great picture. And you know what? In many cases, you can, because the cameras are so sophisticated, they think for you. Some of the new cameras, like Sony, I mean, there was demonstrated to me recently, it will actually take eight pictures at once and analyze the one that likes the best and then give you the top of that one. I mean, you'd have to be a total moron not to take a good picture, which then brings me to the subject of me, because I think I still am a total moron when it comes to taking good pictures most of the time. And a lot of it has to do, I think, with the light. And we'll talk about that and a number of other things with my next guest, the author, the travel writer at World Hum, Doug Mack. Hey, Doug.
Hey, good morning.
I guess the bottom line is, and by the way, you can always say good morning to me, because where we're coming from in Hong Kong, it's always 9 o'clock in the morning somewhere in the world, and it's not morning here, trust me. But
right,
forgetting that, it's okay, I forgive
you. Yeah.
I know, you're just used to doing it. Most people want to talk about, you know, they're great pictures of a lifetime, but there's also the other way to look about it, is the picture you never took.
Right. That's
Explain
right.
that.
Well, the reason that I wrote this piece about that is that I was going to take this great picture in Chicago, had it all framed up, and I was on a bus, and I was taking a picture of a street performer who was drumming, and I had it all framed up, and as I was taking that picture, as I was about to press the button, he caught my gaze, and he sort of shook his head, and I thought, you know what, I can't take this picture. I'm taking with an unwilling subject. And I can't do it. I don't want to sort of intrude this person's privacy. I have been thinking about it as though, you know, this is sort of mine to take. I'm going to capture it. I'm going to share it with all my Facebook friends. This is great. But, you know, who am I to take that moment from him so that I can essentially boast about it and sort of say, look at this great story, look at this great view to my friends on Facebook and Twitter and blogs.
Well, you know what? It's sort of like going on safari in the old days with Teddy Roosevelt to come back with your trophy head, you know, of an animal. But, you know, it's interesting because here we are in Hong Kong. So many of the Asian cultures, and this goes throughout the continent, think it's almost like you're stealing from the soul when you take somebody's photograph.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, I don't know that I would go that far, but you know, I think that there is something to that. I think that when you're taking the photos of a human subject in particular, that person has a right to sort of give you permission. And I think, too, that, you know, quite frankly, that photo is kept in my mind, in my memory, much better than it would have been actually on the camera. You know, it was this sort of ineffable moment, and obviously the ineffable can't be captured that way.
Well, you know, but that's a double-edged sword, because I didn't get a chance to see that person, did I? Because you never took the photo, so you never got a chance to share it with me. So the argument could be, Doug, that you've denied me the opportunity of that moment that you had.
I suppose that's true. That's true. But, you know, I like to think that I can also sort of tell you that story, and it can come alive in a different way, and you can keep it, you can still have it in sort of your mind's eye, and it can still have a richness to it without necessarily seeing the photo. And you know
what? I don't necessarily disagree with that, because I think we've lost the fine art of storytelling, and I think we've lost the fine art of having a conversation when it comes to dealing with our travel experiences. If we go back to the 1950s, the 1960s, even the early 70s, I used to dread when my friends would come back from vacation because you'd end up going to their house, and they'd actually rack up the slide projector, and you'd have to sit there for 2 hours while they showed you all their stupid photos. That, to me, was an ordeal. It wasn't a wonderful experience. And yet, when people would come back and talk to you about what happened, especially when the plans that they had didn't work. I mean, I've always believed that the best travel experiences you have are when the plan doesn't work and you turn left instead of turning right, and that's where you meet somebody who's going to change your life forever, or that's where you're going to discover a painting or someone singing a song, or in your case, that street performer. I think that makes more of a lifelong difference than anything else. And then, of course, if you have the opportunity to come back and talk about it and paint those pictures, that's what you do as a journalist anyway, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly right, what you've just said. And I think that to a certain degree, you know, blogs and Flickr and Facebook have sort of become the new slideshow. And so, you know, as I said, sort of, I find that I'm often thinking, I'm as guilty of this as anyone, I'm often thinking ahead of time, oh, this is going to be so great. I'm going to have all these pictures of this thing. But, you know, to a certain degree, I think I'm almost boring my friends, just like people would back in the slideshow days. And I think that, too, you're right, totally right about sort of the best travel moments are these serendipitous ones. And I think that's one of my big concerns about this singular focus on photography that I think people get caught up in sometimes, because it becomes about taking so many photos of this particular landmark or this thing, because you want to replicate the photos that you've seen in postcards or on Flickr. And with digital photography, you can easily, cheaply. And you get so caught up in taking that photo over and over and over from all the different angles that you miss out on sort of the person walking by who could be really interesting to talk to. You miss out on these serendipitous experiences potentially, and sort of the smells and sounds and interactions outside the frame. It becomes just about having this experience within the camera frame.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I'll give you my other big pet peeve. I have friends of mine, and I bet you, Doug, that you have friends of that qualify for this too, that their definition of what a good photograph is has to include them in it. You know, where does that memo get written? You know, that here I am at the Taj Mahal, here I'm at the pyramids, here I am at the Great Wall. No, how about just like take yourself out of the photo? It's not about you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I totally agree. And I think one thing that's really amusing to me is when it becomes about putting yourself in the photo, but no other tourists, no other visitors. You know, there's this app now that you can get called the Tourist Remover app, where you take many, many photos. Yeah, seriously. And you take many, many photos and it sort of overlays them and it takes out all the people. But I suppose you could put yourself back in. And that's one of the other things that really bugs me about all this emphasis on photography, is it becomes sort of distorting the view and distorting the actual thing that's going on there, because often at these places, there are a lot of other tourists, and that's part of the story too.
I agree. And then the other thing, which is my pet peeve, is I have never seen, I hate to use the word never, I have hardly seen a great photograph taken at noon. Okay? You don't see great photographs taken at noon, and a lot of organized tours will go zipping by the pyramids at noon. And there you see, you know, the sun is just whiting out everything in the shot, and there's one guy on a camel selling postcards. I mean, stop. I love the light, and I want to wait for the light.
Right.
And not because I'm an elitist photographer, but because I figured it out. And so early in the morning or late in the afternoon, those magic hours, that's when you want to shoot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bottom line. And then when you do it, take yourself out of the photograph. Stop it.
Exactly. I'm with you. I mean, now and then, get yourself in there and show that your friends are there, but I totally agree. Just take a picture of the thing that's there.
I agree. Doug Mack, author, travel writer. You can read him, of course, at World Hum. We appreciate that. And Doug, do a self-portrait and send it to us. We'll put it on the website. After all said and done, I'll put it on. I promise, okay?
All right. I will do that. Thanks for having me on.
You got it, man. When we come back, earlier today, I did the unthinkable. I actually went to a dim sum class. I actually tried to make dim sum. You think I did okay? We've got the chef coming on to tell you how bad I really was. It still tasted pretty good, but, well, you'll know when I come back. Back with more from the tallest hotel in the world. 1,600 feet up. We're at the 116th story. And, in fact, we made the dim sum at the 118th story, somewhere up there. We'll be back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after this.
To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit petergreenberg.com. The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now. So call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. Once again, here's your host, Peter Greenberg.
33 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from the top of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel here in Hong Kong, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter at petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. As I said right before the break, earlier today I got a chance to go into the kitchen with people who actually knew what they were doing, and they attempted, emphasis on the word attempt, to teach me how to make dim sum. And boy, it was a whole lot more difficult than I thought. And joining me now, somebody who knows a little bit about that, who's been in and out of Hong Kong for years, the executive chef here, Peter Find. How are you, man?
Great. Excellent. Thank
so
you.
How bad was I, the truth? Come on.
You started slowly. You're
and I got worse.
Something like this.
I mean, it's when you realize how much work goes into making one little dim sum with a rolled dough and the filling. I mean, we take this all for granted when we go to the restaurant and they bring by the dim sum. It's a lot of hard work.
It is.
It's an art. It's an art.
It's an art. You can compare it with a Western word with a pastry chef. It's a lot of small steps involved. You have to make the dough, the fillings, and so on. It's quite labor intensive. They're starting very early, 7 o'clock in the morning, to be ready for lunchtime.
Now, I'm sure in your training, you also trained as a pastry chef as well.
Yes.
But nothing prepared you for dim sum.
Not really.
What's different about it?
I think it's the totally different techniques, the ingredients, the dough, you can have so many different ingredients. And it's just the experience. You know, my dim sum chef have over 35 year experience as a dim sum chef. And it just takes time. You know, you don't have the recipe. You weigh it, but you just feel and touch. And then you have institutions. And then, of course, you stick to the Cantonese style. You have the Shanghainese style, the Beijing style, so many different.
Or the Greenberg style, where everybody laughs at
you. The Greenberg was flat.
It was bad. It was very bad. Not good. You know, you're indicative, or actually, you're actually reflective and an example of so many people here in Hong Kong who were here, left, and then came back, right? Because you were at the Mandarin, and then you, I mean, right, back in 95?
95, yeah. First time with the Mandarin, and then with Repulse Bay, 6 years in Hong Kong, and then it was 10 years abroad, and then the place just have a fascination, you have to come back.
When you're working at a hotel, and let's talk about size and scale. When you're working at a hotel that's this big, that's this tall, you know, it's sort of like asking an airline chef, can you make a souffle? And go, not at altitude. I mean, is it stupid to say, is there something that happens at altitude here? Or can you still make everything up at 116 stories?
We still can make everything. We still even have on the 102nd floor, we still have gas, open fire flames. So it's just the same as normal on the ground floor. You just have a better view.
And as a chef, I mean, Hong Kong obviously being such a gateway city, going back to your first days back at the Mandarin versus now, sourcing has to be so much easier now to be able to get the ingredients that you want.
I think that's the advantage of Hong Kong. You have now, in my old days, you have to order anything overseas 2 weeks before. And you have to really be organized because you can't have any last minute. Now, in these days, you have 3 times a week flying the stuff from Italy, from France, from US. And it's really, you get high-quality products.
What is the most popular dish here that surprises you?
Surprisingly, in the Italian restaurant, we have a dish, it's a tagliolini with Sicilian red shrimps, which is really highly popular. People love it. And the Chinese one, we're selling the Iberico barbecue pork. It's a little bit different than the normal one. It's a premium pork quality, and people love it. You know, it's tender, it's tasty.
And they eat a lot of pork here.
They do.
A lot.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, right?
Yes.
I know. What's the one thing you wanted to put on your menu that you figured people are really going to love it and nobody ordered it? Or one thing you wanted to put on your menu, think, who's going to order this and everybody loved it?
There's always, you know, as a chef, you sometimes you think what you have from experience that people love, and then you look later in the record and say, how come, what is wrong with the dish? It's not moving at all. We had one dish in the lounge menu, which usually is selling comfort food, and we had one salad. We all felt everybody liked it, and all the chefs, we did the tasting, and it's not selling, so we have to take it off the menu. And then
what was it?
It was a salad with spinach salad, which people here love. People with pear, with a nashi pear, grilled nashi pear. It just didn't move, you know, gone.
And what's the most popular one now?
Now we actually, the most popular one is a Hainanese chicken rice.
It's the what?
A Hainanese chicken rice. It's Hainan is an island in.
I know. Okay. Okay. Hainan island
and chicken rice.
Thank you very much. And okay. What's in there?
It's chicken and rice.
Now
and
I got food. It. Nothing gets by me. And what makes that dish special, though?
It's special is the way we present it. It's slow cooked, so it's really, really super tender, and the stock and the rice actually cooked with the stock and with the leaves, and it's just it's melting, and it's
now you
good
mentioned,
value for money.
Now you mentioned comfort food. Is there such a thing as Hong Kong comfort food?
There is. For example, fried rice, a normal fried rice which you eat at your home, a wonton noodle soup. This is more the comfort food. Which people really, really love. A fried noodle dish. This is more the easy ones, a macaroni noodle soup for breakfast. A pineapple bun, a local bolo bao, how it's called here. I think it's something simple and easy to prepare.
And then, of course, there's uncomfort food, which is what I attempted to do today, making the dim sum. I love it. Peter Fine, the executive chef of the Ritz-Carlton here in Hong Kong. Hey, man, thanks for joining us.
You're most welcome.
And keep me out of the kitchen, okay?
Sure.
Really. I knew you would. All right. We'll be back with more of the Ritz-Carlton and Peter Greenberg Worldwide when we come back right after this.
Call now to talk to Peter Greenberg at 1-888-887-3837 or email him at peter@petergreenberg.com. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
MedJet Assist. If you're injured or hospitalized while traveling, MedJet Assist will arrange medical transportation directly to the hospital of your choice. Travel safely and be smart. Get MedJet Assist. Take trips, not chances.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
43 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg coming to you from the Ritz-Carlton here in Hong Kong, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. We were just talking to the executive chef here about items on the menu, but what's interesting about this to me is items in books about food, because I get easily bored by books on food because they lose focus. They're either a cookbook with photos or a travel book with recipes, and neither of them really fits the bill, except the one I just happened to see called Feeding the Dragon. It's actually a culinary travelogue that goes all the way through China. Oh, yeah. And with recipes that even I, the dim sum failure, could even make. And the authors, and I love this, Nate, I'm going to try to say this three times fast, or even one times fast, the authors are Nate and Mary Kate Tate. Did I get it right, guys?
That's right.
That's right.
I love it. So here you guys, you know, what gave you the idea that this would be a great idea for a book, because you're going to do it together? I mean, what did you, I have to ask the devil's advocacy question. What did you guys know about Chinese cuisine?
Sure. Well, the inspiration for the book was really, I was an exchange student in China and in college, and Mary Kate came over to visit one summer, and we ended up getting lost in the jungles of southern China. And for about 2 days, we were just wandering around the jungle looking for a place to stay, and this village took us in, and we slept there the night. The next morning, they made this amazing meal for us with fresh sausage and mango slices, and the table was covered with bamboo leaves, and we just had this amazing experience, and the food was so different than anything we'd had in the States that we knew we had to do some project where we could put it all together and show it to our friends and family back home.
Well, therefore you started this incredible journey by plane, train, believe it or not, rickshaw,
yeah,
motorcycle, horseback, donkey cart, pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, thanks.
We really didn't know. We really didn't know anything about Chinese food when we first went over there, for sure, though.
Yeah, the premise of the book is we go back into people's kitchens and also in restaurant kitchens, and they would show us exactly how to cook, and I'd write down every single thing they were doing, and then we went back home and to the States and tested it all and cooked it and practiced.
And how did that translate? Were you actually able to do it?
Yeah, we were able to do it, and we tried to get recipes that were easy to make in the West, you know, the ingredients that you could easily find and preparation that's not too intensive, like the dim sum you mentioned, which some of that dim sum takes a long time to make.
Man, it takes a long time to make. What would you say was the dish that you wrote down, that you sampled when you were on your trip, and you got back home and went, oh my goodness, this is really tough?
Let me think. I would say that the opposite of that comes to mind is the Peking duck. That I thought that was going to be very difficult to make, and it ended up being, if you don't make it in the traditional way where you pump it full of air like they do in Beijing, but if you can roast it at home and it tastes pretty good, and I was surprised how easy that was.
And you know, when you talk about Peking duck, I mean, you know, you think about it as this duck hanging in a window for 7 years.
Yeah.
And then somebody finally cooking it. That's not what you do, is it?
No, you just baste it in honey and Shaoxing rice wine, and you just want to let it dry in the air, like overnight. Or in our book, we recommend using a hair dryer. You want to get the outside really dry so the skin cooks really crispy. But yeah, I think that the hair dryer is an easy way to get around that.
You cheater. How long did it take you to do this book? How long was your actual journey?
We started doing the book one summer, and honestly, we thought it was going to be done, and I thought it was going to be done in about 3 months. It ended up taking us
6 years.
Yeah.
Whoa. So that was your day job, huh?
Yeah. We got a book deal a year and a half ago, and then we decided we're just going to move back to China and finish it. So we've been living in China for the last year and a half.
Wow. Well, listen, really, really good job. It's a great read. Love the photographs. And you know what? The recipes, and this is a compliment to you guys, they're non-condescending chef recipes. I actually think even after my bad dim sum experience, I could actually do some of this stuff.
Oh, good.
Hey, thanks. We really love it, spell it out step by step, because we were new to Asian cooking as well.
And you did just that. Again, the name of the book, Feeding the Dragon, a culinary travelogue through China with recipes. And the authors, Nate and Mary-Kate Tate. I love that. Thanks, guys. We really appreciate that. When we come back, we're going from food to the arts. And there is a lot of it here in Hong Kong. Back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide from atop the Ritz-Carlton right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Travel Guard Insurance. For travel insurance plans for the unexpected, see your travel agent or visit TravelGuard.com for affordable travel insurance protection from Travel Guard.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
52 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from atop the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, the tallest hotel in the world, as they say in New York. Taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. You know, in all fairness, when you walk around Hong Kong, especially on the streets of Kowloon, even in Central, it doesn't hit you right away of the history here, of the arts, of the culture, of the heritage here. And when I first came to Hong Kong, somebody said to me, oh, would you like to go to a concert tonight? I said, where is it? I mean, I couldn't find it. It was very difficult to find. Now that's no longer the case. In fact, the Hong Kong Arts Festival is 40 years old. And joining me now, the executive director is Tisa Ho. Hi, Tisa.
Hi. Great pleasure to be here.
And happy to have you. I mean, it really has changed over the years, hasn't it?
It has. The whole city has changed. It's grown. It's got so diverse. It's this high-energy city. You have to be here to feel it, you know? And the arts are the same way as well.
Well, yeah, it's one thing to say you hit the ground running in Hong Kong, but you don't want to necessarily hit the ground running for the arts. You want to take your time. You want to slow down a little bit, don't you?
Actually, the arts do offer one opportunity in Hong Kong to slow down. People are running, you know, nonstop.
Of course.
So actually, when you actually give yourself, you know, the hour, 2 hours or whatever, to sit in a concert, that's a great time for yourself. Last year, we did Tristan and Isolde, 5.5 hours. And I thought, nobody in Hong Kong is going to pay 5.5 hours to watch this German opera. They did.
Did they have subtitles?
Yes. We short title everything. We short title Cantonese opera as well. So you can come watch that and know what's going on.
That wasn't the case when I first saw it. Yeah. It was like, oh my God. You know, I didn't know what the hell I was watching. You know, but this is good.
Yeah. This is one city where we short title everything in English and Chinese. And the city where there is equal amount of expertise in Cantonese opera, in Peking opera, in German opera, you name it. So I have a wonderful job. But I also have, you know, thousands of critics I need to answer to. So I watch my step.
What would be the most surprising display in the Hong Kong Arts Festival that I'm not going to that I'd be surprised and amazed to see?
Well, just right from our website, you know, we have.
And the website is what?
The website is Hong Kong Arts Festival. It's that simple. And
.com.
.com. Okay. Just Google Hong Kong Arts Festival and you'll find us.
Okay.
We also have an iPhone app, which is kind of cool. But what I have had American.
Do you know anybody who doesn't have an iPhone app?
One or two.
Okay, fine. They're
getting with it.
Soon. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have American friends actually tell me that they went on our website and they Googled, they looked at opera and they found, you know, Wagner, Mozart, but also Cantonese opera and Peking opera and Nanjing opera and like, oh, wow, yes, this all of this opera stuff. And I think only in Hong Kong this happens.
What about visiting artists? Who have you gotten that would be a wow?
Kevin Spacey.
Cool.
Yeah, he came and did 5 performances of Richard III, like back to back to back to back.
Wow.
He had never been so high energy. The man is amazing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, remember, he's now with Royal Shakespeare. He's doing...
The Old Vic. Yeah, absolutely. So that was a BAM and Old Vic production that came here. We've had just the big Americans. We have the New York City Ballet. We've had New York Phil, Chicago Phil, Merce Cunningham.
I love you, the New York Phil, the Chicago Phil.
Hey. Yeah, and we've got the Royal Concerto Cabal next year, you know. So it's... Hong Kong is an international city. It's a very open city. So we... I don't know, maybe we should, I'm not sure. We don't call it the International Hong Kong Arts Festival, the Hong Kong International Arts Festival. But we kind of don't bother because if it's Hong Kong, this is the way the city is. It's very open, very international, and we do music, opera, dance.
You know what I think, and please correct me if you think I'm wrong. I don't think the hotels in Hong Kong do a good enough job of engaging their own guests in the arts here. Because I don't think the guests even know about it. And I think that's something they should be doing more of.
I amen to that. You know, that would be a very good thing to do, just to let more people know.
Because if you go to most hotels, you know, they got the rack of brochures in the lobby, and there's always the tours. It's always the tours and more tours. What about, hey, I bet you didn't know that. You know, I always want to know. When I go to a city, I ask two things. I want to go see the fire department because they know everything. The fire department, they know. They've been in everybody's house. They know, right? And the second thing is, I want to talk to the bellhops and the maids to say, hey, who's playing in town? I want to know what they want to go see.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to see stuff. I mean, I remember landing in Nairobi one day and asked everybody, who's playing tonight? It was Barry White. Barry White in Nairobi? I actually went to the concert. I was the only white guy there, but I was there. And you know what? I had a great experience. But I never would have known if I had asked for the hotel to tell me.
I'll tell you one thing about the Hong Kong Arts Festival. We tend to sell about, we will do 172 shows next year. And we tend to sell our tickets. So, you know, 95% of the tickets will be gone. So by the time you
that's where your hotel concierge comes in because they can find one.
Depends on the concierge, yes.
Oh, come on. The concierge at the Ritz-Carlton, if they can't get me a ticket to see Barry White in Nairobi, well, now they can't. He's not with us anymore. But the point is they can do it.
Yeah, true.
See? Okay.
I love to work with the hotels.
Give me the website again.
HongKongArtsFestival.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Tisa. Tisa Ho, the executive director of the Hong Kong Arts Festival. And the next time you come to Hong Kong, ask your hotel concierge who's playing tonight. The answer actually might surprise you. And guess what? You might actually go. That music means we're ending the whole show. We're out of time. Lots of people to thank, of course, our chief engineer, Mike Worrell, once again drawing the short straw, being forced against his will to come to Hong Kong. Boy, I feel so sorry for him. Jeff Ryder back in the East Coast doing the boards back there. Our chief producer, Shelley Goncharowski, here with us in Hong Kong. Bonnie Kwok on the staff of the Ritz-Carlton. And, of course, the entire staff of the Ritz-Carlton Hong Kong. We'll see you next week, guys, from a different remote location somewhere around the world.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Visit our website at www.petergreenberg.com.